Blog Talk Radio.
We are live from Mill Valley, California, and our sister city, Larkspur, just over the hill. Welcome, everyone. This is Greg Masters. I am your producer and co-host of the broadcast This Week in Health Innovation, which is brought to you by healthinnovationmedia.com. Check us out on the web. Okay, so today, I'm usually joined by my co-host, partner, co-founder, co-inspirationer for this broadcast, Pat Salver, and we usually interview movers and shakers in the industry. So today we're going to turn the tables a little bit, and we're going to put Pat in front of the microphone, and because I want you to know a little bit more about my colleague, Pat Salver. So, Pat, are you on the line?
I am. You turned the tables on me. You did.
You're in the quote hot seat today. So there's been no prompts. This is entirely ad hoc. And so let me start off by telling our listeners. First up, I met Pat Salver several years ago at a conference in San Diego. It's called Healthcare Unbound. And we met in the front row. And you know the sincere people at conferences are always in the front row. We met in the front row.
Or at least the ones that are nearsighted. That's short.
Right. So we sat together, and I think we were listening to Vince Caritas or some of the usual suspects, not to disparage Vince in any way, but we were listening, I think, to Vince. And we got to talking, and I learned from you that you were a physician with a history in emergency medicine, but also medical administration, and that you had gotten involved in social media, principally through the blogosphere. And you talked to me about this website that you curated called thedoctorweighsin.com. And then I asked you about whether you were doing anything at that moment on Twitter, and your answer was no, and I assisted you in signing up for Twitter and creating visibility there. So our association began at the Healthcare Unbound conference, and then our paths crossed frequently thereafter at Health 2.0 conferences, the Health Data Forum, which became the Health Data Palooza, health camps, and on and on. And we decided over the years, since we had similar interests, that we would come together, and the net effect of that collaboration has been the formation of what is now healthinnovationmedia.com, which actually had its beginning in March of this year at the HIMSS meeting in New Orleans under the rubric of the then Health Innovation Broadcast Consortium. So that's gone somewhat dormant, and you and I have moved forward in terms of developing health innovation media. Now, with that as context and background, I want to read the audience a little bit about Dr. Pat Salver, who was an MD, MBA. Some of this I was not aware of. Dr. Pat Salver served as the chief medical advisor of Dr. Base. I assume that's past tense, but I'm reading from...
No, I'm an advisor of Dr. Base.
So you're still an advisor.
But they have brought on a full-time chief medical officer. That was never my role, but I continue to be an advisor to John Kim, an amazing entrepreneur, and John is actually an advisor to me. So a nice reciprocal relationship.
Okay, and this is sourced from Bloomberg Businessweek, the database. And so you're still an advisor. You're a physician executive and serial entrepreneur, and more about that later. She's also served in leadership positions in a variety of organizations, including health plans, medical groups, employer organizations, and physician associations. She's experienced in leading complex clinical implementations, such as transition to a new pharmacy benefit management company, a PBM, and implementation of a multi-million dollar integrated care management system. She served as Senior VP and Chief Medical Officer of Universal American, formerly Universal Financial Corp. Prior to joining Universal, she was an independent healthcare consultant and principal in PRS, Strategic Healthcare Consulting. She provides clinical expertise to health plans and other clients that want to optimize process efficiency and clinical outcomes for populations with a high burden of chronic illness. Dr. Sauber has been a member of the National Clinical Advisory Board at Healthcare Innovations since October 2007. She founded and led both for-profit and nonprofit organizations. She's board certified in emergency medicine and internal medicine, and is a fellow of both the American College of Emergency Physicians and the American College of Physicians. Dr. Sauber holds an MD from the University of California, San Francisco, earned an MBA from UCI, that'd be University of California, Irvine. So, Pat, you've got a pretty eclectic, diverse, deep experience both on the clinical side from your days at Kaiser, which I don't even think is referenced here, is it? It's other than just emergency medicine. From Kaiser into medical administration, more recently then into the social media domain, and then perhaps the most recent part of your curriculum is in the crowdfunding and crowdsourcing space, creating a company called Health Tech Hatch. But I want to start with the Dr. Wei Zin. What got you drawn into and involved with social media, as you like to refer to yourself as the curator of the blog, thedrweizin.com?
Sure. Well, it's an interesting story. I don't know if you can call it an eclectic background, you can call it a checkered background, but I have had the opportunity to be there and do a lot of it when it comes to healthcare, which has been interesting to have kind of your eyes on what's going on from many different vantage points. The way I got into the blog was that I was working with a small company called Peer Trainer. That was doing, it was one of the first online weight loss programs. They actually started about the same time as LinkedIn, but unfortunately have not had the trajectory of a LinkedIn, although they're still in business and still doing okay. My husband, who's a physician and a technology guy, and I are investors in that company. And I started writing for them. I started writing for Peer Trainer, but then I ultimately decided that I wanted to move the writing off into an independent site. So that was the genesis of the Dr. Wei Zin, which initially was a blog that I wrote for primarily, you know, a post every day or two. And the focus is the WEIGHS suggests was on weight loss, nutrition, diabetes, insulin resistance, and kind of that whole spectrum of issues, which were really important then are even more important today as the obesity epidemic and the diabetes epidemic have continued to progress more or less unabated.
And was this a function of your engagement with disease management and obviously diabetes being one of the high-cost areas?
Sure. It was a bunch of things. I actually, I think one of the things that wasn't in my bio was when I trained at UCSF, I ended up doing a fellowship in endocrinology and had the good fortune of working with some of the giants in diabetology. Peter Forsham is one of those names in that field that people say, oh, he worked with Peter Forsham. And so I had a pretty good background in diabetes and diabetology. I'd co-authored a chapter for a Lang publication on diabetes. And so when you added that to what we learned from the era of disease management that was for the mid part of my career, when we all thought that this was going to be the solution to the cost and quality issue in the United States, it was really clear that if you're going to do disease management, at least one of your focuses has to be on diabetes, common, costly, and there are things that you can do to improve the outcome. So kind of logical, but all that background led into why I did a lot of writing in the early days of the Dr. Wei-Hsien on that topic. But then gradually, you know, I started to write about other things, and pretty soon I was writing about whatever I felt like, which was really fun. So I, you know, wrote about, you know, apps that, you know, measure your sexual activity. I wrote about getting pedicures with little fish that come and eat your dead skin, and, you know, just about anything that caught my fancy. And all those are still available if you go to the Dr. Wei-Hsien and you wade through the 3,200 that are on there. But eventually my husband, who, as I said, is a MD, PhD, background in immunology and served as a chief medical officer for a biotech company, he decided that he wanted to write. And it turns out that he has a big fan base. His writing is so interesting. So whereas I might write about, you know, some new drug and diabetes, Dove will do this incredibly integrated, complex evaluation of the neurobiology of being a Democrat, or the history of the color purple, and other things. And we actually last year went through and took all of his blogs, which there were many, picked out the best, the ones that, you know, that the readership told us were the best because they had the, you know, the most people reading them and commenting on them, and we turned it into a book, The Dr. Wei-Hsien, on almost everything.
That's a great book, by the way. Because I agree, he's a gifted writer, and not only is he thoughtful and intricately engaged in his subject, he's very witty as well. So, yeah, Dove McKelley, check it out in the About tab of the drwei-hsien.com. So let's backtrack a little bit to your experience at UCSF. You're a woman physician who, at the time that you were training, were in the, without a doubt, were in the minority, both in terms of count and culture in medical school. Talk a little bit about your journey through that process and what some of the challenges you faced.
Sure. I tell this story to young women a lot because when I, and I'm going to back up a little bit before UCSF and talk about when I went to college, I had this idea that I wanted to be a doctor. I don't know where it came from. First I wanted to be a vet, then I wanted to be a doctor. No one in my family had actually completed college. My father had gone for a couple of years. So I didn't have kind of a family culture or history of not only going to college, but, you know, doing something as time-consuming as going to medical school. So I took off to San Jose State, was before it was San Jose State University, and I signed up as a pre-med. And my counselor tells me on the first day that I meet that I don't want to be a pre-med because women don't get into medical school, so I think you should major instead in medical technology. Being a lab tech, I think could be interesting, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And so I continued as a pre-med, but I ended up, I got to take you back way, way back. This is when girls went to college and got MRS degrees. So I indeed got my MRS at the end of my third year of college. I got married and worked for a year and then went back to finish college, and we were living at Berkeley, and I had the amazing experience of being enrolled at University of California, Berkeley during the 60s. So I was there for all the major upheavals, People's Park, Reconstitution. You know, we studied, we were studied to the smell of tear gas, and I mean, it was just an amazing time to be there. But I'm still kind of left with this, well, girls don't go to medical school, you'll never get in. So I decided to go to graduate school instead when I finished my degree, because no one told me it was actually harder to go to graduate school in the topic that I picked, which was physiological psychology, than it was to get into medical school. And that was where I met my first mentor, who was my professor in my PhD program, who got to know me and said, you know, Pat, I know you really want to, you know, do clinical medicine as opposed to research, so I'm going to help you. So by that time, I'm 27 and I have a three-year-old, and I applied to medical school, and it was before they had this consolidated way of applying, so you actually had to apply to each school. I applied to four schools, And I got my first rejection so fast that I actually thought that it was my application coming back, and maybe I forgot to put the stamp on the envelope. And I completely struck out. So then I decided to get into the medical school by job, and I figured out the whole game, and I, you know, got to know women doctors, and looked for mentors, and went to work at the Berkeley Free Clinic. For those of you out here, that was a very famous institution in those days, and reapplied to every school that didn't actually write in their description of who should apply that don't bother if you're over 26, because remember, this is the days when you could do all this discriminatory behavior. So I applied to 26 schools, and at the same time I'm applying was when the women's movement kicked into high gear. So my message to all the young girls is, you know, you may say you don't want to be a feminist, you may, you know, make negative remarks about feminists, but feminists changed the world. I got 3 interviews. I got 1 acceptance, which was UCSF, which was my first choice. And indeed, I was in a class that had more women than they had had in the past, but it was still relatively small. I can't remember now, 15-20%. But it was an eclectic group of people. UCSF did an experiment where they brought in older people, they brought in women with children, they brought in, we had a ballet dancer in my class, we had an attorney in my class, we had a former nurse in my class. It was really an eclectic group that as a whole have gone on, now that we're pretty much at the, you know, back end of our medical careers, these people looking back have made incredible contributions to the field. It was just simply a wonderful class and a wonderful training program.
And this was the first admitted class? Oh, under this new policy?
Well, I don't know if there was a formal policy, but we were the first class that was as different from the prior classes, which were, you know, kind of traditional right out of college, white male pre-meds. So we were more diverse. The class after me was even more diverse. As a matter of fact, they were raging feminists. I mean, the stuff that they did to the professors was like, I'd go, oh my God, you did what? So it was a pretty amazing time.
So you're well suited to be sort of an esteemed faculty and participant in some of the XX in Health programming that's gone on the last, I believe, 2 years now, some of which we've had an opportunity to participate in. And for those of you following on Twitter, I just tweeted the clip that XX in Health put up on their site, xxinhealth.org, under the video tab, that has a cameo appearance of Dr. Pat Salber, and she is discussing the very subject we're dealing with right now. So you're in and you're at UCSF. Talk about some of the challenges that you experienced as a medical student.
Well, I think that, you know, I had a unique challenge for my class, because when I went to medical school, although my husband had been supportive of me applying, he decided he didn't really want to be the husband of a medical student. So I ended up being a single parent at the beginning of medical school, and my son was 4, and obviously I didn't have a lot of resources. So I had those challenges, but overall I was so excited to be in. It was like you couldn't, it didn't matter what you wanted to throw at me. 7 midterms next week. Sure, bring it on. I love it.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I think I read the whole textbook of internal medicine by Harrison. You know, in those days, we carried around textbooks. I was really thrilled to be in medical school. I loved the preclinical years, which, you know, a lot of people don't like, because in those days it was a lot of, you know, memorizing and regurgitating. I loved the clinical part. I loved the challenge of figuring out a diagnosis. I just altogether had a great time, and actually my son, who, you know, his young years were 4 years of medical school followed by 3 years of residency and 2 years of fellowship. So it was, you know, his entire childhood was me in training. And when he went off to go to college, he said, what do you want to be, Jace? What do you want to be? He said, I don't know what I want to be, but I know what I don't want to be. I'm not going to be a doctor like you. And, of course, he changed his mind, and he's now a radiologist in Boise.
So how did you settle in on what was to become your specialty in terms of postgraduate training?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because in the years that I was in training, there was this heavy push to go into internal medicine, and people in when you would meet with your advisors, they actually said stuff like, "Well, you know, the really smart people go into internal medicine," and so I thought I was really smart, so I went into internal medicine.
Of course.
And I got into the UCSF, what they call the straight internal medicine program, which was, as opposed to another program that they had that was more primary care based, this was the program where everybody was going to do internal medicine and then do some sort of a subspecialty fellowship. And it was very interesting because in my group, the year after me, UCSF beat Harvard in the match. It was a very prestigious program. But in my group, I would tell you that at least half of the folks in that program ended up doing something else. Some went into surgery, and a bunch of people went into emergency medicine. And I fell into ER serendipitously because I was working at Kaiser. I did my residency half-time so I could spend more time with Jason. And I would be admitting people to the ER through the internal medicine clinic, and the ER docs kept saying, "Oh, you got to come down. We want you to come down and work with us." And I finally did go down and work with them, and that was it. I was in love. I mean, it was like, you know, could you have a more exciting way to practice medicine?
So was it more like ER or scrubs?
It was like ER, but we didn't get trauma because we were in San Francisco and we weren't the trauma center. But let me put it to you this way. When I was an endocrine fellow, I worked up a person that we thought had a very rare endocrine tumor called a VIPoma, a VIPoma. And it took a whole year to work it up because you had to send the samples off to different places, and then it took them a long time to, you know, do these specialty tests to evaluate it. And at the end of the year, it came back, and the results were conflicting. So I said to my attending, "Geez, what should we do?" You know, it didn't really confirm the diagnosis, but it didn't disprove it either. He said, "Let's do the workup again." So that was internal medicine. I go in the ER. And you get people coming in really sick with problems that I knew how to take care of because they were internal medicine problems. And, you know, an asthmatic would come in and you'd treat them with the asthma drugs and they could breathe again, right? You know, it was just for me, it matched my personality. It matched, it worked for my endorphins, right?
So this attraction to problem solving was at the very deep granular level inside of you.
I really loved the cases that came in where people were, you know, not that I wanted them to be super sick, but they were super sick, and you had to be a detective, right, and look at every clue and try and figure out, you know, what it was, particularly if somebody was so sick that you knew that time was of the essence. So I really liked that. But I also liked the kind of quick feedback of, you come in really sick, I give you something, you get better, you say, "Thank you, doc." That's nice.
Got it. So the skids were greased to the pathway into Kaiser and therefore emergency medicine. So you spent 18 years at Kaiser.
I did. I practiced emergency medicine for a large part of that, and first in San Francisco and then in South San Francisco. And then somewhere along the way, I did a Pew Fellowship in Health Policy at UCSF with Phil Lee, who went on to become the Assistant Secretary of Health under Clinton. He'd been Assistant Secretary under Johnson, and then he got to be Assistant Secretary again under Clinton. And he suggested that I start working with a group called the Family Violence Prevention Fund. So I got really involved in the issue of family violence, and along the way met a physician executive at Kaiser who basically said, "Oh, you probably wouldn't want to do this, Pat, but there's this job in corporate headquarters, it's looking for a doc, you know, I mean, you really wouldn't want to do it, would you?" And anyway, I did want to do it, and I did do it, and that was my transition out of clinical medicine into kind of medical management or being a physician executive.
So now that presents a whole different set of challenges. What kept you and keeps you, for the most part, there, other than the last several years of the innovation addiction. I don't know if that's fair to say, but the interest in cutting edge innovation. What kept you in that HMO / eventually ACO medical administrative mode? What was the glue there?
Well, so the first job I had at Kaiser nationally was I was there, the doc that worked with national accounts. So it was the big important purchasers back in the day when we all thought that employers were going to be the ones that would save healthcare. And so, you know, I worked with IBM, I worked with Xerox, GTE, you know, some of these companies aren't around anymore. And as a result of that, I had an opportunity to go and spend 6 years as a physician executive support with a team of people from Kaiser supporting the healthcare benefits work that General Motors was doing. And GM at the time was the largest private purchaser of healthcare in the world. And the person that I worked for, Bruce Bradley, was just this incredible, innovative leader in the world of health benefit design. He actually was one of the co-founders of the Leapfrog Group. We called him the Bullfrog. And so we were, at the time, I know when you look now and we're all looking at health tech, but at the time, what was going on in the purchaser world was cutting edge and was exciting and was innovative. We designed a tool called that's now called Evaluate, which is a RFI that we developed from scratch, not me alone, but a group of people from 8 purchasing coalitions that's still used by purchasers today to help evaluate health plans. So it was really exciting. I mean, I was lucky to be, you know, kind of in the right place at the right time.
So I'm going to fast forward because we're coming up on 5 minutes out. But let's talk about the relevance of that to what we're seeing now in terms of ACO marketplace. I mean, is there direct relevance? Is what you formulated there and were part of implementing at corporate and health plan levels, is that still relevant today from an ACO perspective?
Well, it's interesting. You know, GM, one of the things that they wanted me to do at GM was to help build a new health plan with associated delivery system in Dayton, Ohio. Bruce Bradley, who I mentioned that I worked with, had, you know, loved Kaiser. He loved the Kaiser model. He had worked with Rhode Island Group Health in the past, which was a similar model, and wanted to try and make that work in some of the communities that were really important to General Motors. Well, if you look at the fundamentals of those kinds of organizations, they're really very similar to what we're trying to do with ACOs. It was the whole idea that you get away from, you know, fee-for-service, one-off, uncoordinated, unintegrated care. So do I think ACOs are relevant? I do see them absolutely as relevant. I mean, I think Kaiser's done a marvelous job, and you can call it an HMO, you can call it an integrated delivery system, but it's got a lot of features of what the ACOs are trying to deliver.
So the delivery of the system of the future or the sustainable one will have some, if not most, of the features that we're seeing in integrated delivery systems like Kaiser as an example. Okay, so now let's bring this forward. All of that brought you to blogging and writing, and blogging and writing brought you into cutting-edge stuff, and ultimately you've decided, I believe I was there at the origin of the conversation, which ultimately led to the birth of Health Tech Hatch. And I believe it was a breakout session at Health Camp DC with Regina Holiday as the scribe, and we were talking about crowdfunding. Talk to me about your growing interest in crowdfunding as a task worthy of your time, and then ultimately what you chose to do in the launch of Health Tech Hatch.
Sure. And again, I always have to back up a little bit because, you know, I had been doing a lot of consulting with health plans in the time leading up to forming Health Tech Hatch. But I was starting to become aware of this health tech revolution that was taking place. I mean, Ground Zero, Silicon Valley, San Francisco. And I started going to meetings and talking to folks, and this actually preceded the health camp, and kind of asking people, well, what can I do, right? You know, I'm not a technology person. I can't write code. You know, how can I contribute to this, the promise of this incredible movement? And I made a first pass at it with a company called, wasn't really a company, it was a website called Health Tech Match, where I was going to, you know, match entrepreneurs with the resources that they needed. And then, you know, I showed it to some people, and they said, well, it's really nice, Pat, but, you know, you don't quite have it right. What we want is money. We want someone to help us get money, and we want we really have a hard time connecting with consumers and doctors to get feedback as we develop our products. And that was really, you know, the genesis of HealthTech Catch. It happened that the crowdfunding movement was just starting to heat up at the time that we started it, and so that was why our, you know, the initial product that we rolled out was our crowdfunding site.
Yeah, so get us the money. That probably makes sense. So what was your early experience in terms of some of the crowdfunding initiatives?
Well, I just did a big review of this for a talk that I gave. Here's what it looks like, is you can crowdfund small amounts of money for health-related projects that don't have consumer-facing devices or gizmos or gadgets. And it looks, by looking across all the sites, you know, I myself and my team spent some time doing this. You know, people can raise $5, $10, $15, $20,000 doing this. But the big ones, the ones that, you know, that everybody thinks about when they think, oh, I'm going to crowdfund, I'm going to do what Scanadu did, or I'm going to do what Pebble Watch did and raise millions. You know, those successes, as far as I can tell, look like they're limited to people who have products with a broad consumer appeal. And a lot of those campaigns are really pre-sales and not necessarily, hey, come and give me money for my good idea. So I think we have a lot to learn about how to make this successful so it can fulfill the promise of an alternative early stage funding for people's good ideas. But it's going to take some morphing, I think, from the existing model.
And part of that morphing is you've partnered with Indiegogo, is that correct?
Yeah, we decided it turns out to be pretty costly and time consuming to manage your own crowdfunding site, and when you're in a vertical, you're not really going to scale. So we decided to use the back end of Indiegogo and concentrate our efforts really kind of on the front end functions. And so far, that looks like it's a reasonable strategy.
And you've also morphed into a crowdsourcing, particularly in co-design. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So right after we went live, we had a call from Health and Human Services that was doing a challenge, one of these projects where people compete to design stuff and win prizes. And they wanted to include feedback from consumers as a part of the challenge, and they used our site to do that. So we've done two of these co-design projects so far, both of them with Health and Human Services, one for healthfinders.gov campaign, and the one that we just completed was for the Blue Button Patient Co-Design Challenge.
Well, Pat, there's a lot to talk about. What I really hadn't had a chance to get to was just how you went head down on Dr. Ways In. Your focus shifted to HealthTech Catch. You went a little bit off focus there on Dr. Ways In and more into cloud sourcing and co-design and all that. And I was hoping to get more into the lessons learned, but I think we touched on that. And so we're going to close out this session. We could actually spend quite a bit more time on crowdfunding and crowdsourcing. But do you have any just sort of summary thoughts before we close out the talk today?
Yeah, tootle on over to Doc Ways In. We haven't given up on it. We haven't lost our focus. We have a whole new look and lots of new writers. So check us out, drwaysin.com.
And by all means, check out healthtechhatch.com for activities that are going on in the crowdfunding, crowdsourcing domain. So we have been speaking with Dr. Pat Salver at Doc Ways In on Twitter, curator, publisher of drwaysin.com, and CEO of HealthTech Catches, and my partner and co-founder at healthinnovationmedia.com. Check us out. Pat, thanks again for your time. We do this weekly on Health This Week in Health Innovation. Join us next Wednesday at a regular time, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, for another episode. Thanks again, everybody. Bye now.